Hi, thanks very much for being here. This is the Data Visualization and the Future of Research panel. Thanks for coming on the 3:30 afternoon slot. There's a lot of things we actually wanted to see at this session this time, so thanks for coming. So I'm going to introduce our panelists and just talk for a second about data and let them do the talking. They're the experts. So we know data are everywhere, and now we're all thinking about big data. So science and scholarly research, which is what the focus of this is, where this is coming from, has always been about been composed of data from the first publication in 1665 by the Royal Society. So this is a long history we're building on here. Hold on. Okay, so data, of course, isn't the sole province of the scholarly and research community. Data is being leveraged by nearly everyone, everywhere, for most everything.
There's no slide.
Okay. So because we're collecting so many data points, how can we comprehend this? Computers have always crunched data for us. Computers, which were, of course, originally women, calculating missile trajectories for defense initiatives, are now machines capable of handling vast amounts of data. But too much of it is really too much for us to understand just by looking. So the trick for all this is to make it more comprehensible. That's where the visualization comes in. Visualization techniques are one way to comprehend this, and we'll hear more about this. What I also wanted to raise the issue of data sonification, which we're not going to be talking about, but is a really cool thing that people are thinking about. We've had data sonification with us for a long time, such as people using sonar or Geiger counters. These are mechanisms for conveying data to users. There's actually a really cool current project at the MIT Media Lab by the Responsive Environments Group with Joe Paradiso and Ben Hogue, and they're utilizing sensors embedded in the Media Lab architecture to display audible output of real-time sensor data. So that's a cool thing that maybe we'll talk about in a few years. So our panelists here are Josh Greenberg, who is from the Sloan Foundation. He's going to be representing the epistemological roots of the discussion. And don't rush for the door. and the view from 30,000 feet, where presumably it's sunny up there. Josh is a program officer at the Sloan Foundation, where he focuses on science and technology initiatives. He holds a PhD in science and technology studies from Cornell University. And he's written a wonderful book called From Betamax to Blockbuster, Video Stores and the Invention of Movies on Video, which my press published. So, of course, it's good. This illuminates, amongst other things, how communities of users and consumers change to technology and industry with their choices. Our second panelist is Johan Bolin. Johan's an associate professor at Indiana University's School of Informatics and Computing. Johan has a PhD in experimental psychology, and he was a staff scientist at the Los Alamos National Labs. Johan had a paper in 2010 on Twitter mood predicts the stock market, which received major attention in scholarly technology and major media circles, which is kind of a coup. And he's recently achieved a kind of fame most of us don't get by being the subject of a spam. What exactly is it? Yeah. Are you going to talk about that too? A spam scam featuring him. So that's something we all can't say. He's a principal investigator developing quantitative tools to better capture and measure scholarly impact through citations. So he'll be giving a talk on that. Our third panelist is Lee Dirks. Lee Dirks is the director of portfolio strategy at Microsoft Research, where he collaborates with academic and research organizations on complex scientific and social projects. Lee will be walking us through two projects that have been developed at MSR, ChronoZoom and Layerscape. And then you might notice this is really skewed towards the sciences, and we also want to address the humanities. So we have our late add-in for our panel here, who is Jo Guldy. She's going to talk about how we can use these technologies and these techniques for the humanities, and she's a historian, so she'll be telling us about large-scale history. So without further ado, Josh Greenberg.
Great. Is the volume okay if I talk like this? Is the volume okay if I talk like this? I will move my laptop over and move this closer. How's that?
Yes.
Outstanding. So thanks, Margie. Margie has impeccable taste, not just in putting this panel together, but in deciding to publish my book. So I appreciate that quite a lot. So I just want to give a few minutes of broad overview, give some language to talk about some of the things that we're seeing happen in the scholarly world. In particular, I want to talk about the idea of the macroscope, which is a term that's starting to get batted around that I find really useful to talk about things under the heading of big data, visualization, data science. Standard disclaimer, I'm here representing myself, not officially the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, but I do work there, and this is the stuff that we're really, you know, getting in up to our chin with. So think about instruments. Think about the telescope. The telescope is a physical instrument that lets you see far. It's a technology. When we think about the data of the telescope, it's the star field. It's the information out there that the telescope lets us get our head around. It lets us see farther than our human limitations and our human senses, our eyes, allow. Think about the microscope. The microscope lets us see small. The microscope lets us see things that we couldn't see with our bare eyes, and lets us come to all sorts of conclusions about the natural world. So take the idea of a macroscope. Think about something that lets you see big, lets you see beyond the scope of what the human brain could comprehend, given the length of our lives, given our ability to process information, even working collaboratively. The notion of a macroscope is this sort of one way of talking about a kind of compelling vision of being able to do research at scale. Joël de Rosnay, a French philosopher, wrote a book in 1979 called The Macroscope. This is a great little cartoon from it that kind of sums this up. I particularly love the fact that the microscope lets you see stars, the telescope lets you see stars, the microscope lets you see the infinitely small, the macroscope lets you see society and nature. And there's something really interesting there about bringing together these things that have traditionally had very different ways of understanding, ways of knowing. So what does a macroscope actually look like? Now, here's an example. How many people in the room are familiar with this or have seen this? All right, so the brief version for those who haven't is Google went and scanned a lot of books. And particularly a team of people based out of Harvard, some colleagues of Joe's and others, built an interface for asking questions of those books at scale. What you see here is a graph of the word science mapped against appearances of the word technology as they appear in literature from 1800 through today. So this is an interesting visualization. This lets you start to ask all sorts of interesting questions that, frankly, no one is actually going to read the corpus of material that this is being worked off of. Books are by no means the only body of data. We're seeing a ton of interest. Johan will talk a bit about Twitter. A lot of people are thinking about how to use the Twitter fire hose in interesting ways to develop new kind of tools or ideas. My personal favorite, if you're not familiar with the OKCupid blog, there's a data science team there that are thinking about essentially macroscopic ways of understanding their data set, understanding how you can at least correlate answers to certain kind of questions with the ways that with predictions about the ultimate viability of, say, a couple. So I work at the Sloan Foundation. Most of you probably know us because we support Radiolab and Science Friday and American Experience. We also support a lot of scientific research and social scientific research. We helped to get a project started called the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, which was essentially a base map of the skies that all astronomers could work off of. There was a project called the Census of Marine Life, which took a similar model, building a sort of aggregate data set off of hundreds of marine expeditions to develop a census of the sea that would let you understand migration patterns. This is a wonderful visualization of migratory patterns that National Geographic produced based off of that data. In current projects, one of my colleagues is running a program on the microbiology of the indoor environment, understanding the microbes and fungi and critters that live indoors, which poses an interesting question. Individual researchers go out, take samples of particular buildings, run sequences of them, gather that data, do that analysis. There's a certain set of people who want to do metagenomics, who want to do meta-analysis of that work. In order for that to work, you have to pool the data and then start to understand how you visualize it, how you make sense of it. I don't have anything to show because this is sort of on the frontier right now. But the big point is is, as Margie said, you start with data. The conversation these days starts with data. And in fact, it often uses language of big data. And the thing that I want to throw out to the audience right now is that really it's big data and computation. And when we talk about visualization, we're not talking just about the data. And it's sort of misdirection if you just talk about the data. You're talking about the tools and the algorithms and the computation you're applying to that data. And that fundamentally is, that's the apparatus of a macroscope. I'll put a reference in to, there's a colleague of Johann's, Cadi Borner, at the University of Indiana, or Indiana University, who has a great sort of research program. This is from an article she wrote. She says her aim is to inspire computer scientists to implement software frameworks that empower domain scientists to assemble their own continuously evolving macroscopes. It's a sort of agenda called plug-and-play macroscopes, the idea that you don't want to build from scratch. You want to actually, you know, get to a point where these are modular pieces that can be connected. We're still in relatively early days right now of this. I like to say that if you compare it with the telescope, we're still in the days when Galileo was grinding his own lenses. And we've got a lot. There's a lot of work to do before things become mainstream, and there's enough of a division of labor and sets of roles that this kind of method is really plug and play. The kinds of things we'll see are still kind of on the frontier, but are becoming more and more mainstream and becoming more abstracted over time. So, as Margie said, I want to throw this word up, and please don't run for the door. anyone who took an undergraduate philosophy class will remember that epistemology is the study of how we know what we know. It's how we make knowledge, the processes and the tools and the ways of knowing. And so I'd suggest that for the past at least 20, through the 20th century, we really got to a point where there were two main ways of knowing. There was a model based on the scientific method, where you develop theories, you pose experiments that could prove those theories wrong, you run those experiments. If the theories stay up, then we can kind of rely on them. And there's a sort of humanistic, hermeneutic model, not just humanities, some social sciences, but an idea that knowledge is produced out of close readings of texts of human behavior. By paying close attention and developing readings, you can get to a sort of sense of knowledge. And so the question for me, this was framed really clearly by, this is Flip Cromer, who has a company called InfoChimps, and I heard him frame this particularly, is there an epistemology of big data? Is there a way we make knowledge that's different from either of those? And I kind of think that the more I've thought about it, the more I think that there is. There's a sort of instinctive sense that you're not deeply reading individual texts or individual items, and you're also not posing hypotheses and just testing them. You're getting a big pile of data, and you're working iteratively with it. You're combing it. You're looking for features. You're moving back and forth. And you start to see this structure popping up in a lot of places. Lee's colleagues at Microsoft Research, and Lee, in fact, helped to produce a book called The Fourth Paradigm, where looking at the sciences made an argument that the sciences have moved through an experimental, theoretical, a computational, and now are focused on a data-intensive paradigm, that the sciences are starting to work not just by posing hypotheses and testing them, but by sort of working in a sort of data science vein. A friend of mine, Steve Ramsey, who teaches English at the University of Nebraska, published an article where he talks about the screwmeneutical imperative, or the hermeneutics of screwing around. Which is fantastic. He talks about walking into a library where you're not necessarily just looking for a particular book, but you're wandering, you're browsing. I've noticed in the program for South By a number of sessions that use the word serendipity, which I think taps into some of that same sense of not pure goal directedness, but of kind of iterative back and forth, you know, poking at stuff. It starts to look a lot like twiddling dials and playing with knobs and moving sliders and sort of really engaging with the data, and ultimately producing visualizations that let you develop knowledge out of it. So the one point that I want to make about this, I think this is, I've tried to be sort of descriptive until now. This is what I see is going on. And I think what's really interesting is to think about trust. The kinds of ways of knowing, the ways of making knowledge that I talked about, are solid because we trust them. Because there's a sense of you can work backwards and understand where the knowledge came from. You can build on the shoulders of those who came before. That's sort of what knowledge since the Enlightenment has been about. In the sciences, we talk a lot about reproducibility, about the ability to go back and rerun experiments, to test that knowledge, so it's not just one time. In order to do that, you have to understand the constituent pieces very well. In the humanities, you cite the text you work with must be cited. That's about establishing a chain of provenance that goes back so that somebody else could follow that reasoning back and make sense of it. And I'd put out there that as we look at the sort of visualizations and as you think about that and as we all sort of hurtle forward into experimenting this new way, that it's really important that we don't lose that sense of trust in the results, and that we pay attention to how we can maintain that trust in new technical platforms, in new methodologies. And the last thing that I'll say, because this is also gonna touch on particularly some of Johan's work, in the academic world, we think a lot about sort of the tools we use for research, and then the tools we use to disseminate research are very different. And what we're seeing now is a conflation of the two. That in the humanities, scholarship is starting to show up outside of traditional journals in blogs and elsewhere on the open web. In the social sciences, in a number of fields, preprints are starting to show up in the Social Science Research Network and other platforms. In the sciences, whether it's PLOS ONE or I didn't mention it, but Archive, the physics, math, astrophysics repository. More stuff is showing up on the open web, and it gets even worse once we start throwing the data sets and the code and the other things that are being used to produce these visualizations out there as well. And what's really compelling is to think about taking the macroscopes that we're using in biology, in economics, in history, and turning them back on the academic literature itself in order to better understand what the trends are, what is compelling research, getting beyond sort of traditional ideas of impact and to a much more sophisticated sense of, again, how knowledge is made. So with that, we'll get down from 30,000 feet, and I'll kick over to Johan, who has some cool stuff to talk about.
Okay, so I should speak into the microphone like this, right?
Okay.
Let me quickly hook this up.
That was the perfect lead-in for, you know, what I was planning to talk about. I'll try to first start with an example of how in my own sort of career, if you can call it that, I've experienced the tremendous changes that have taken place in how science is conducted and how those changes are being driven by social media and new ways of evaluating the outcomes of scientific research. Right, so let me give you an anecdote of what happened, and this actually feeds into this whole thing about Twitter mood predicting the stock market, right, because I promised to at least mention that. So this is effectively what happened. Right, so somewhere in the fall of 2010, I thought I had a really cool idea, and I talked to a student about it, and I had a good student that started to work on it immediately, and we made what we can call a surprise discovery, because we weren't looking for this. And she effectively correlated a sentiment analysis that we performed across very large-scale Twitter feeds, right, mapping the world's fluctuating collective mood state from one day to the next, and we correlated it to the stock market and found that we could actually predict the stock market with an accuracy of about 85 to 90%. Right? So we thought that was good. We thought it was a really cool discovery that we made by analyzing very large scale data sets, and that we weren't really looking for to begin with. So it took us about 4 months to write the paper, and then of course we tried to get this into a top journal. Right? I'm not going to name any names, but you know who they are. And so what happened is that 6 months later, we found that it was declined for lack of broader appeal. So apparently predicting the stock market is a little you know, footnote. And anyway, so that was really disappointing. So we rewrite the paper, we reformat it for Top Journal 2, because that's what you do. You engage in that cascade, right? If one journal doesn't take it, you know, it's like Homer Simpson falling down the ravine, bumping his head on all of the various levels. And soon enough, so there we go, we reformat the whole thing. I'm sure a lot of you actually recognize the format. Came back, also declined for lack of broad appeal. The editorial board didn't even refer it for peer review. You know, it was just decided that, again, it was not relevant. And I don't know whether, you know, you've ever seen me throw a hissy fit, but it's, there's people in the audience here that have actually witnessed this. I mean, it was a little bit like Hitler getting really upset about the third... the third reviewer screwed him, and that's kind of what happened. I had crying students in the hallway, and I was anyway. So what we did is, what I told my students is, you know, F it, we're going to throw it in archive, and then we'll see what happens. So on Thursday of that week, we uploaded it to archive, which is a open access preprint archive for physics and computer science, etc., and it's being tracked by most people in the physics and computer science community. So it was Thursday, right? And so here's what happened. So Thursday we make our submission. By Friday we had about 3,000 hits on Google if we search for the title, because I do that. I'm vain like that. I actually look up my own name. Saturday we had 50,000 hits on Google. So I thought, well, there's something going on here. Sunday we had 70,000 hits on Google, and the first bloggers had identified the first errors in the mathematics of the paper, which were not detrimental. They weren't, you know, it wasn't like they invalidated the paper, but just little typos, etc., that were corrected, and to a tremendous amount of detail. Tuesday had an appearance on CNBC, right? I received more emails with reviews of the paper, some of them like 20 pages, questioning our assumptions, the statistical analysis. Oh, but that's me. As I said, I'm a little vain. Anyway, so, I mean, people went out of their way to analyze this paper. I mean, I don't think that even those top journals would have been able to provide peer review on a paper like this for about 1,000 different people, right, going over every single detail in that paper, correcting every even the smallest mistake. This is me looking very tired and answering a bunch of really inane questions in CNN. Wednesday, more reviews, Bloomberg Television, etc., and more peer reviewing going on, right? And why am I showing this? I mean, it's not because I happen to have been on television or anything like that, but just because I'm really astonished by the level one, that level of attention that that paper got, but how fantastic the crowdsourced peer review of this paper was, well beyond anything you would expect from even one of the top journals. And that kind of really struck a chord with me, because over the past 3 years, I've been effectively working on sort of a study of science, a scientific study of science itself, and trying to determine how we could better assess the impact of scientific publications from very large data sets. So if you look at how, I don't know how many of you here are publishing scientists, you know, if you can call it that, but the way that it works is you have an idea, you write the paper, you submit it, goes to peer reviews, you can see it gets rejected 3 or 4 times, you reformat it, a couple of years later you publish it, and then there's, when you've published it, then people can actually cite it, and then 6 or 7 years after the fact, the first citations will show up in citation databases, right? And so let's just say you're coming up for tenure, as I recently did, and your dean wants to know whether you're hot or not. They're going to check citation statistics, right? But if your career is pretty short and you've done your best work in the past 4 or 5 years, you won't have citations. So really the way that we study science right now on the basis of publications, right, traditional publications and citations, is like looking at a star system that is 50,000 light years away. We're not seeing that star system as it exists today, but as it was 50,000 years ago. And that's kind of how we've been studying science and studying scientific impact, and I think it's totally inane. Now, especially because most scientific publications are accessed online, so we have fantastic usage data where we can track what scientists read, when they read it, what they read it in conjunction with, etc. So we decided to actually start looking at usage data, if only because of the enormous scale and the fact that it's available at very early stages in the scientific publication process. Now, here I need to talk a little bit about impact metrics. How many of you know about the journal impact factor? Oh, okay, quite a few. Essentially, the journal impact factor is a method by which you count the average number of citations that a journal receives over a 2-year period, and you divide that by the number of publications that were published in that journal. So, for example, Nature, over the course of 2 years, they collect, I don't know, like 10,000 citations, and they published 100 papers, so the impact factor would be 100, right? And that is being used nearly universally to see how good someone is. If you publish in Nature, has a high impact factor, that's deemed to reflect on you as a scientist. It means you're doing good work because you're now associated with that journal. But the problem with that reasoning is a little bit, I mean, let me show you these two albums, right? I mean, how many of you know the album of the singer on the left? Can I get a show of hands? I mean, come on, don't be, no. All of you do, come on. And how many of you do know the album on the right? This may be the wrong audience for this.
Yeah. Okay. Come on.
Totally wrong audience. Okay.
Skewed data.
Anyway, yeah, it's totally skewed data. This is not a good sample. But anyway, so the album on the left sold 83 million records. The one on the right sold 50,000 records when it was first released. And the band actually, you know, disbanded shortly after because the disappointment was too much to take. Now, if you ask who was influenced by the singer on the left, right, if you do a pop poll among artists and all that, very few will say, well, you know, one of her influences is Britney Spears, you know, really changed how... No, no one is going to say that, no. But if you ask about Big Star, man, you can ask R.E.M., Teenage Fan Club, Placebo, Mortal Coil, Wilco, all of these people will gush over how this one album changed their musical careers and how they aspire to achieve that kind of greatness. So in terms of influence, they've been tremendously important, but in terms of total record sold, not so much, right? Now, I usually show this as a joke, right? But the truth is, this is how we evaluate scientists. So if you publish stuff that is cited a lot, that means you're good. If you publish stuff that is not cited so much, you're not so good, and your tenure might become an issue, right? And I think that is so last century. I mean, nowadays, in sort of the social and the social network age, your influence is determined by who you know and who knows you, right? And how influence kind of circulates through those social networks, rather than just account how often you're being referenced by someone, right? So when we talk about usage data, I want to stress that we're looking at sort of relational, contextual data. Okay, so what's measured? I'm going to give you a very quick review. This is a project that looks at establishing network models of science, and we're not advocating for any particular metric. I'm not trying to sell you a system. We don't have a website, you know, nothing where people can go and use our tools that we developed. It's a scientific project. It started at the Los Alamos National Laboratory in 2006, and it's still ongoing with the generous support of the Los Alamos National Laboratory with the Andrew W. Mellon funding and the NSF. So a quick overview of the results that we did. What we essentially did is that I sat in front of the phone and started calling publishers, aggregators, and institutional consortia, right, like the University of California, and just asked them for their log data, because they all have web servers and they record what scientists read. And funny enough, they all donated their usage data. It was as simple as just calling them, asking them, say, yeah, we'll send you a drive. And before we knew it, we had a couple of billion usage events, and it's still growing, that cover about 50 million articles and 100,000 serials. And so here's what we can do with that kind of data. Right? And I'll go through this really, really quickly because I've got 3 minutes left because I've been ranting about my paper and TV appearances. So what we did is we looked at that network, and essentially we used sort of Amazon.com logic. We're essentially saying that we looked at how many people in a particular session read one journal in conjunction with another journal. A little bit, if you like this journal, you'll also like this one. And so we scanned our usage data for looking for those kind of associations, and we ended up with a map like this. And it's one of the largest scale visualizations of sort of the flow of attention in the scientific community, where you can clearly see physics and chemistry right there, see biology is green, you can see medicine and healthcare on the left, the humanities and the social sciences right in the middle, a sort of a wheel with the hub right in the middle. And so this is one of the maps that we produced of the sort of scholarly communication system. I won't go into that, but in these maps you can actually determine the importance of a journal, not in terms of how many connections it has, but where it is in that map. Right? I mean, if you would remove any of these journals from that network, you would cause significant damage to the structure of that network and the flow of attention, be like having a little seizure that destroys some connections in your brain, right? It's like sort of the global brain of science, if you will. And so you can measure the importance of a journal in terms of how well it holds together that structure, and that's exactly what we did. So you can come up with all kinds of really sophisticated metrics of how much scientific research matters. What I'll conclude with is simply saying that this usage data, since it's recorded in real time, allows us to actually look at bursts of activities and study science as if it's sort of a flu infection. Ideas kind of spread from one scientist to the next and propagate as if it's a virus. Right? And you can clearly see, for example, that you've got these waves of infection passing through the scientific community where people suddenly start reading things in particular domains because they've been infected by other scientists that have talked to them about the cool work that has been going on there. So we can track effectively, you know, not just what scientists read, but when they read it. And we're being funded by the NSF right now to see whether we can actually detect emerging research fronts before the scientists themselves are aware of it. And we've got some really interesting examples of an analysis at the Los Alamos National Laboratory where we actually found one of those clusters emerging, and I'm not allowed to speak to it or I'd have to kill all of you. But, Yeah, these bursts are canonical. Here's some of our papers that you're free to read. Most of them have actually been submitted to the archive, and you're free to download them. And you know, I'd love feedback, so send me email. That's it.
Cool. Hello. Well, if Josh was up in the clouds and up in the stars, then I'm going to take us back down to Earth and actually a little bit underground as well. So, let's see here. Bear with me. There we go. So I'm on a team within Microsoft Research called the Connections Teams, and I always like to explain a little bit what we do. My team is actually not researchers. We're actually responsible for initiating collaborative research projects with academics around the world. So in areas where Microsoft Research may not have a strong research presence, we work with some of the top researchers around the world to help us scale up or to use some of our algorithms on external data, et cetera. So, we do a lot of our research, a lot of our projects in partnership around the world, mostly with academics, sometimes with private industry. But we're always working on kind of groundbreaking research. We're doing things that the product groups aren't going to do. Although Microsoft Research overall is a pure research division, our team is a little bit more applied, but we're still trying to do some groundbreaking things. And we're very focused, as I'll stress the last part, on interoperability. But I'd like to set that up to explain some of the context for the projects that I'll be telling you about. Specifically, we have five areas where we do research: core computer science, natural user interface, and health and well-being. And then the two areas where I'm going to show you some examples of our projects: Earth, energy, and environment. And I'll be talking about a tool called Layerscape, and education and scholarly communication. I'll be talking about a tool called ChronoZoom. The kind of MO for our group is to, as I mentioned, to do these collaborative research projects. What we're trying to do is not necessarily just maybe write papers or give presentations or ideally get a few patents, but we also actually want to release software that people can use. Even though it's research grade, not quite, you know, product quality per se, we like to make sure that, you know, people get the bits. So everything that our group does is available for free, and a vast majority of it is actually available open source. And so I like to stress that part. So there's a URL on the bottom that you can go and check out some of the projects that we have. We probably have 40 or 50 live projects. I'm going to show you two today. The basis, and again, kind of as Josh was pointing out, the basis of this is data-intensive science. So we're trying to focus on sciences, social sciences, humanities as well. Anything that is doing work with big data, we want to try and focus on. And that's kind of our illustrative place where we work. In 2008, Microsoft Research, our same team, released something called Worldwide Telescope. And I'm curious, how many people in the audience have heard or have used Worldwide Telescope? A small percentage. Okay, this is an amazing tool that I highly recommend you check out. So this was actually a vision originally from Jim Gray, someone that Josh mentioned earlier, one of the researchers at Microsoft. And he visioned a way of stitching together all of the astronomical visual data that's collected by all the Earth's telescopes. So this is literally a viewer. It's available as a web client, but there's a richer Windows client that you can use, and that's what I'll be demonstrating today. In addition to using Worldwide Telescope to visualize the stars, we also have used it where you can turn around and look at the Earth. And so what I'm going to be demonstrating is how you're able to use those visualizations and be able to use your own data to visualize it on Earth, but also how you can share that data, visualize it, and make tours and videos that you can share with friends. So what we've done recently is release Layerscape. This is something we released about 2 weeks ago. And it's fundamentally, it's just a website. But it's a website where you can upload your data, share your data, visualize it, build videos or tours of that data, and share it, and build communities around data sets. So it's a place for, and from a matter of provenance, it's a place where you can track, where people can take your data, do their work on it, share it back, et cetera. So it's at layerscape.org. So what I'm going to do now is, everyone pray for me. I'm going to do a live demo here. Oh, God. All right, so I'm a researcher, and I've got some data in an Excel spreadsheet, and it's not very illustrative. It's not really showing me what I want. So what I'm going to do here is I'm going to go up, and I'm going to select these four columns. I'm going to go down to the end here, and I'm going to say that's what I want. And I'm going to go up, and this is a free add-in from the Worldwide Telescope site. So you can go up, select this little thing, and I'm going to say visualize selection. Now what this has done right now, just automatically, it's keyed into the rows and columns, and it said, it looks like you were talking about color, longitude, latitude, and magnitude. And I've matched that up, yes. And it's really quite simple. I'm going to say visualize in Worldwide Telescope. And what it's done right here is it's taken that information and mapped it onto Yellowstone. And so what that was in that spreadsheet was actually precipitation data for January in Yellowstone. And so now I can zoom in, and this is just, you know, one thing that you can do and visualize quickly and look at, you know, what the snow factor was like in different areas, et cetera. And so that's one thing that you can do with Layerscape. Now I can also share this. I can actually build a tour of that, and I can take you and walk you through and visualize different parts of Yosemite. So what I'm going to do now is actually show you one of those. Oh, sorry. Oh, awesome. It's going to be downloaded. So what this is actually visualization data of the earthquake and the tsunami in Japan last year, actually, a year ago tomorrow. And this is an example of... Here we go. And this is seismic data that's been uploaded. And this is actually a tour. So at any point, I can actually stop and drill down. And this is all the seismic activity that happened. This is actually worldwide. This happens to be focusing on Samoa and Japan. And I can actually stop this, hop ahead a little bit, play again. And so the data is live. I can actually stop, utilize that data set like it is, you know, like it is a tool, but I can also, it's getting a little jumpy on me, sorry. I can actually use it, stop it, play around with the data a little bit, and that's the actual the seismic activity off of the coast of Japan last year. So it's a pretty interesting tool for scientists to be able to quickly visualize and share their data in that way.
How do you share it, if you don't mind?
Sorry? By uploading it to the Layerscape website. So you can actually sign in here and upload it and share it, and other people have been doing that. So what we're trying to do is, if you look down here, you're actually seeing featured data sets, latest, top ranked. These are the actual tours, and this is actual the data. So you're able to do that in that space. So it's layerscape.org. So the things I'd like to share with you about Layerscape is it's a website for publishing, sharing, and finding and visualizing geospecific data. It's built on top of Worldwide Telescope. This is a free service that we're making available to the community. We're actually hosting the data in Azure, so there's no storage costs. And I want to stress that it's not just flat maps. As you can see, powerful visualizations. It's based on the Worldwide Telescope Experience Engine. You can build tours and actually build communities around that data. The next thing I wanted to talk about was ChronoZoom. And this is building off of a work from the International Big History Association. We actually worked very closely with this gentleman, Walter Alvarez, at Cal Berkeley. He's an amazing scientist. He's actually the guy that predicted that we would find out that a large asteroid struck the Earth and caused the extinction of the dinosaurs back in the 70s and the 80s. And he worked with us to help us actually visualize time. And so what we've actually developed and releasing next week, we actually haven't released it publicly yet, is something called ChronoZoom. And so these are some screenshots of the beta. And so I'll give you a demo of it in a second. And so this is the tool itself. And we can take a look at, this is looking at what big data is known for, is looking at all historical events in the context of cosmos, the Earth, life on Earth, and then history. And so we can look at cosmos here, we can drill down and specifically look at Earth, and this is using HTML5 and applications of deep zoom technology for Microsoft. And then you can look specifically at life on Earth, or then you start to get an idea of the scope of time by drilling down into human prehistory. Or then you can say, I want to specifically look at the history of man, and you can zoom down, and you start to get a little bit of an idea of how important we are in the bigger cosmos, right? So there's some amazing things you can do. If you're, I'm going to drill down into here specifically. Say you're a teacher and you want to lecture your class a little bit about Industrial Revolution. What we've done is we've worked with, at this point, curating with a lot of top academics around the world to curate, hand curate the data. So what we have here is, and I'll drill in, we have these things called info dots. And this is where we're able to embed a lot of data, and so or visualize data in rich media. And so I can zoom out a little bit and look at, you know, what's happening in the Industrial Revolution in Britain at that specific time. And these are all based on metadata associated with these specific images, and they're embedded, and then you can link the items together in these info dots. So you can drill in, and in this particular case, I can go into a document and actually look at historical documents. So we look at this as a huge opportunity for museums, for libraries, for archives, to make their collections very available. This is something we plan to make available to the community as an open tool. For the near term, while we're in beta, it's going to be a very hand-curated tool, but we want to open this up to the community, frankly, like a Wikipedia for visual material. So I'm going to zoom out again and say another thing that you can do, not unlike what I was explaining to you for... that's not what I meant to do. Go back here. History of Canada, that's not what I was looking for. Sorry about that.
Not that it's not very
it's
important.
Awesome. It's awesome.
Important.
I encourage you to look at it in more detail. What I wanted to show you, sorry, is the tours. And so what you can look at here is, in this particular case, we're going to look at, in World War II, we have, I've actually turned the volume off, but there's actually a narrator here that's actually walking you through, and you can actually build bookmarks and build tours around the information. So taking the data, but actually in the rich data and the rich metadata, and showing you exactly, you know, someone can actually just click ahead and take you through the specific information. So here's historical documents, videos in some cases, and you can walk through and tell the story, narrate that, and share that as a tour with other folks. So hopefully that gives you a little bit of an idea about ChronoZoom. Thank you for your patience. What I'll stress about ChronoZoom is it's shipping next week, and I hope you will check it out. For the time being, well, first off, it's a zoomable interface that you can use. We have the ability to embed, frankly, any kind of content in there. We have examples from YouTube, from Vimeo, PDFs, scanned documents, et cetera. Coming soon will be that authoring platform that I mentioned. Right now, we're using that with specific partners, but very soon we're going to be opening it up to the community. We really think that this is going to change the way people learn, the way people teach. We think you're going to be able to surface things from Khan Academy, things from your university library, and make that available very broadly. And by looking across domains, by looking across time, and being able to compare different times and different things, you'll be able to kind of glean new insights. And we think it's going to be kind of a very cool way of discovering new content by building these tours. So it's a free web service. It's actually an open source project. We're building it out technically outside of Microsoft Research, and it's being housed on CodePlex and via the Outer Curve Foundation. And I will leave it at that. And I hope you'll check out those tools. We have a.
Okay.
I'll also point out that I've in the back on the back table. I have a few handouts about these tools that I hope you'll check out.
So this is a nice segue into Joe Goldie's work, which is actually looking at these big maps of time that Microsoft has made into something that's accessible to all of us. But let's hear from Joe from the humanities standpoint.
We live in a world that's characterized by decaying paper. Pieces of text are manufactured every day by each of us, and those pieces of text go nowhere We're very good at sorting, and we're becoming very good at sorting information in real time about when events are released and where there are earthquakes. But we're becoming, each of us, very bad at looking back over the events of our own lives or over human history in order to understand where it is we've come from and where we're going. And as we generate more and more text every year, this problem is going to become an increasingly important part of research. So I come to you as a historian, which means that I'm an expert in looking at old decaying pieces of paper and understanding where we've been and where we're going. And I'm a specialist in particular on technological utopias, on schemes that have worked and schemes that have failed, and how we use the decaying bits of paper around us in order to understand which ones messed up and why. So I'm showing you pictures from the decaying books of the Detroit Book Depository. I made a film about these books in 2009. You can find it on archive.org. These are decaying textbooks. They were part of a utopian experiment in several senses. Part of the utopian experiment was the public education system of Detroit. Part of the utopian experiment was the city of Detroit itself. Both of them are in a state of decay, and they leave behind bits of paper and imagination like these, which mark the urgency of making sense of failed utopias. My first book, Roads to Power, was a history of the idea of infrastructure in the 18th century, the origins of the civil engineer, the graphic designer, as experts charged with leading us into a new age of information revolutions and communication. And when I worked on the 18th century, my problems were tiny. If I had to find out about a political problem, I could read every treatise written in that century. It might take a long time, but I'm a quick reader, and I could read them, and I did. When I started working on the 20th century, and by the way, Austin Convention Center, Ballroom G, tomorrow at 1 p.m., you can hear the entire story. When I started working on the 20th century, my problems got much bigger. No one can read about the utopian experiments of the 20th century and which ones failed and which ones succeeded. No one can read this bulk of information. My second project is on Participation Restored, the long history of ideas about the commons, about rights to land and rights to water and solar engineering and appropriate technology and all of those attempts by people who are hitting retirement right now in the 20th century to design a better world upon technology and the communication revolutions behind them and the paper on which that communication depended. I need to be able to read more paper than I can possibly read. Well, I'm interested in these things that I'm calling paper machines. Look at that. That's a machine. I could imagine, if you will, 100 arrays of 100 filing cabinets each. Each of these filing cabinets shoved with paper. Each of those pieces of paper, the product of 10 works of doctoral labor under some disciplinarian advisor. Imagine that much paper. The UN did a census of these utopian projects around land reform in 1955, 1959, and 1969, and they found, just writing up the citations, 10,000 articles. Just on land reform, 10,000 articles. I can't read it. I need macroscopes. So, I work with technologies that other people make, and we live in an era when these macroscopes are becoming refined. I have data and I'm willing to play, so I make things like this. This is built on Zotero and Simile, a technology for timeline visualization. It came out of MIT about 5 years ago. I threw up all of the dates for land reform movements around the world. There is no historiography on this. My colleagues do not understand this. We don't know how to attempt to understand time on this scale. It's new for historians, it's new for humanists, but a few of us are willing to go there. We have big questions for the technology. I threw up all of these dates, I color-coded them. This allows me to ask rapid questions about things like when banking and the private sector started to experiment in utopian technology alongside the state and engineering. This allowed me to chart geographically the spread of land reform movements from North America and Europe to South America and Africa, where they set the stage after 1950. And this showed me where to go in the archive, so that when I needed to actually start reading documents to tell the story exactly in terms of names, dates, places, who, when, where, why, I could look at this and I could see how the colors shifted about 1945 from the yellow and blue that mark out in this case India and Mexico to South America and Africa, and I could read narrower and narrower and find my way through. I know how to navigate paper, but I need macroscopes. So I think the problem for the next generation of coding, the next generation of sorting these macroscopes and honing our lenses for the Galileos of the future is a human one. It's the human problem of the coders who are building these visualizations technologies, finding anthropologists, economists, and historians like me, people who care, people who have big questions, who need to sort through huge masses of paper, forming friendships with them and meeting together on a regular basis in the same space over tea, coffee, and booze to talk about their problems so that we can start throwing these experiments in map and visualization against the wall, against real questions about the utopias that we try to build, which ones succeed and which ones fail. You need to work with people like me, so we need to hang out.
All right, so let's see. Are we going to... We have heard from all of our panelists here, and we've heard a range of ideas on visualization and on data. But Lee, actually, I'll start with one question, and if people have questions, please come up to the microphone, or I can go around Sally, Jesse, Raphael style, whatever works best. But Lee mentioned interoperability, and Lee was the only one to mention that, but I think that is a huge issue with big data and visualization, and I was wondering if all of our panelists might say a word about that.
Me first? Well, even though I'm at Microsoft, a lot of our projects we stress trying to be as interoperable as possible. We are building prototypes and demonstrators. A lot of our projects in a specific area, we're not trying to say this is the way Microsoft does it. We're trying to find out the way the physicists do it or the way the biologists do it or the way the librarians do it, snap to those protocols and guidelines of that particular domain. So that's the fundamental to a lot of the projects that we undertake.
Okay. Johan?
Well, I think interoperability is an absolute requirement for the kind of not just the research that we're doing, but to enable that research actually to evolve into tools that scientists and people interested in studying scientific progress and sort of the evolution of the scientific work. I think that's one of the most major challenges right now. Without these kind of systems becoming interoperable, I don't see how any of this could evolve into something that will be useful to the community.
I'll just add one thing, which is that a lot of times data is really useful for contexts other than that which it was generated for. And some of the most interesting sort of visualizations come from data that's being repurposed in different ways. I think we have a handful of very straightforward ways of making data from different contexts interoperable right now, certain ways of performing joins, essentially, on geography, on time. Though, frankly, when you start drilling into it, time is a really tricky thing. If you're dealing with archival collections or other things, it's tricky to match time in different scopes. One of the things at the Sloan Foundation that we're thinking a lot about are where are those sort of join points, the points of leverage, whether it's ontologies or data standards, that let data from different contexts be brought together. Those are public goods. Those are things that are essential to be able to aggregate data to the scale that people here want to work with.
Mm-hmm. So you raise a really good point, actually. I just wanted to say this while it's connected to what Josh was saying. We do have these masses of data, and we don't often know. Josh did mention the provenance of data, and that is something that we do need to think about. There are people who are thinking about the problems of big data. I would point you to a really good paper by Dana Boyd and Kate Crawford called "The Big Data: Six Provocations," and it's on the SSRN site, or you can, I'm sure, Google it, Bing it, find it online. But people are thinking about the issues because it's not, this data is not something that everyone can just grab and use and come up with great results. Question?
Thank you for a neat panel. Is this on? I'm Philip Resnick from University of Maryland, and I work on language analysis and sentiment analysis and social media and other things in that, along those lines. And I want to raise a challenge that hasn't been mentioned so far in this talk and get your comments on it, which has to do with the quality of the instrument. Opinion Finder or other tools, for example, that do sentiment analysis have an error rate. Things that automatically classify texts as to being about business or finance or other categories have an error rate associated with them. I worry a little bit that in terms of the hype cycle graph, there are aspects of this cool technology that might have the problem of moving up that little peak toward the peak of inflated expectations. And so I wonder if you could talk a bit about the importance of the instruments themselves that are producing the data so that we don't simply rely on the stuff we're seeing.
Right.
Yeah, no, I honestly think that's an enormous problem. I think you've hit the nail on the head. I mean, that's an enormous problem because the only way to fix that, right? I mean, that's what scientists do, right? We make sure through peer review and very careful analysis and calibration that our instruments actually produce valid results, right? A lot of our efforts are really based on cross-validation of the results that we have. And the only way to automate that and to make these kind of data sets interoperable is to have the machines, right, achieve a level of intelligence where they can actually perform inference and reason about the quality of the data and the quality of the instruments themselves. And I think we're very far removed from a future like that. But I think that's one of the bigger challenges. And you know, you nearly have to solve the question of artificial intelligence before you actually get to a point where you have machine actionable instrument data.
Well, yes, but you can start by including error bars in your visualizations, for example, or other ways of visualizing uncertainty.
Well, that goes without saying, absolutely. Yeah.
Again, I would also point you to the Boyd and Crawford paper too, because they raised this, and it's obviously, you know, something to be contended with. Question over here.
Yeah, two questions. I guess the first was to Lee. I was just curious if you were also doing any research into natural interfaces in some of this data. It seems like there could be such interesting ways to kind of hear about that. And generally, to the panel, I'm just curious to hear what your thoughts were about the potential predictive models around some of this data. I don't know if you guys have probably all heard of the article about targets using data to predict who's pregnant and what they're going to buy, et cetera. But I'm just curious to hear your thoughts about that.
Can you all repeat what you're answering when you answer?
The first question was, I think, directed towards me, was specifically about using gestures and ways of actually interacting with data in more natural user interface, not using mice, et cetera. Yes, we have done some of that already with the Kinect and Worldwide Telescope that allows you to use that visualization tool. But we're actually kicking off some research in our next year, starting in July, specifically around scientists and using new gestures and new interfaces for that. It's very experimental, very early, but I think it's going to be some exciting work. The second?
Yeah, the second one, I don't know whether that was directed at me, but I mean, you really ask about predictive analytics, right? That's playing an increasing role in science and industry. And I think that is largely a result of near qualitative changes brought about in these methods by the availability of very large data sets, right? And here the instrument, or the quality of the output of the instruments is not so much in question, right? Because if I buy diapers and I buy, you know, beer, that is an observable fact, right? There's very little error bars in making those kind of observations, and we shed information throughout the day with everything we do. And I think what you'll increasingly see is that computing power and the algorithms are catching up with that data, and we're seeing some very interesting applications where I'm hoping that society will be involved in some kind of a beneficial feedback loop where not just as individuals we will gain more information about our daily activities and, you know, we'll have machines analyze our patterns of living to produce better outcomes, but we can perhaps do that as a society as well. Now, I don't know whether target necessarily determining whether women are pregnant is part of that beneficial cycle, but in general, for example, if you look at the spread of disease is being monitored through Google query analysis, right? And people type in symptoms to find out what ails them, and you can actually determine it with a relatively high level of accuracy how many people in a particular area have been infected with the flu or any other diseases. It's obvious for public health policy, for politics, for decision makers, that could lead to much better decision making. And I think what we're really seeing is that we're already shedding all of the data, and the algorithms and the machines are catching up, and hopefully some good will come out of it. But I can definitely imagine some dystopian scenarios.
All right, so it's 4:30, and it's time to end the session. If you have any questions, please come up. We'll be glad to keep talking about this. But thanks very much.